Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, May 19th, 2023. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy announces a pause in the debt ceiling negotiations between House Republicans and the White House, reportedly over a disagreement about federal spending caps. House Republican negotiator Garrett Graves saying he walked out because it's just not productive and the White House team is just unreasonable. A White House spokesperson saying a path to a reasonable bipartisan budget agreement is still possible, as long as both sides recognize they won't get everything they want. It's now less than 2 weeks until the Treasury Department says the U.S. will default on its debt without a debt limit increase or suspension. President Joe Biden at the Group of Seven Leaders Summit in Japan, the G7, with a joint statement about the war in Ukraine. Our support for Ukraine will not waver. We will not tire in our commitment to mitigate the impact of Russia's illegal actions on the rest of the world. Leaders also discussing relations with China. We'll talk about the G7 meeting with Daniel Lipman, Politico, White House, and Washington correspondent. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in New Hampshire ahead of what is expected to be an official announcement next week that he's running for president. New Hampshire is expected to be the first in the nation Republican presidential primary state. Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, making it official today, filing his paperwork to run for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. And a bipartisan congressional bill to require new vehicles have AM radios at no additional charge, as several automakers have stopped installing them. From Associated Press, debt limit talks came to an abrupt standstill Friday after Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said it's time to pause negotiations. And a White House official acknowledged there are real differences that are making talks difficult. Speaker McCarthy said resolution to the standoff is easy if only President Joe Biden would agree to some spending cuts Republicans are demanding. It's unclear when negotiations would resume. Congressman Garrett Graves, Republican from Louisiana, one of the House members representing Speaker McCarthy in the talks, told reporters as he left the meeting today that there are no updates and we're not there. And he said the decision was made to take a pause because it's just not productive and they're unreasonable. He spoke to reporters as he walked along.
How did it go?
No updates.
Are they giving on work requirements?
Sure. Are you going to be meeting more today? Do you expect a deal, buddy?
We decided to pause because it's just not productive.
What do you mean press pause? Did it get stuck in
the
box today?
I don't know.
Tomorrow?
I don't know.
Do you think you'll be meeting in person this weekend?
I'm not sure right now.
Are you coming out?
I mean, why did they put it in pause?
It's just unreasonable.
In what way? Are you going to meet the speaker? Are you confident that you can get
The House passed a strong bill that has great savings in it, and it's responsible, and it puts us on a path to that occur. And until people are willing to have reasonable conversations about how you can actually move forward and do the right thing, then we're not going to sit here and talk to ourselves. So that's what's going on.
But the body language is not looking good here.
Congressman Garrett Graves, Republican from Louisiana, with reporters in the U.S. Capitol. After he left the meeting with the White House representatives in the debt ceiling negotiations, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the U.S. could be unable to pay its bills and might default on its debt as soon as June 1st. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy also spoke to reporters in the hallway about the pause and what changed from his tone on Thursday that a deal was close and the House could vote as early as next week.
Congressman Graves said that there's a pause. What is going on?
Well, we've got to get movement by the White House, and we don't have any movement yet. So, we got to pause.
The tone seemed really optimistic yesterday, is it?
Yeah, I mean, yesterday I really felt we were at the location where I could see the path. The White House is just, look, we can't be spending more money next year. We have to spend less than we spent the year before. It's pretty easy.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, with reporters today. A White House spokesperson, not named, telling NBC News after the debt ceiling talks broke up today, there are real differences between the parties on budget issues and talks will be difficult. The president's team is working hard towards a reasonable bipartisan solution that can pass the House and the Senate. More from the Associated Press article, Speaker McCarthy is facing a hard right flank of Freedom Caucus and other Republican lawmakers, almost certain to oppose any deal with the White House. The internal political dynamics confronting the embattled Speaker leaves the Democrats skeptical of giving away too much to the Republicans that drive away the Democratic support they will need to pass any compromise through the Congress. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, talked about this in an interview on the Politico podcast, Playbook Deep Dive.
It is so important for us to emphasize what the actual stakes here are and also the context that we're in. The debt ceiling is not a vehicle for wholesale political agenda setting. It cannot be that because we cannot have the entire stakes of the full U.S. economy put at risk over a political back and forth. There's a strong reason why this has not been a vehicle for negotiations, and it should not be a vehicle for negotiations. Now, in terms of the policy of what Kevin McCarthy is trying to propose, this is not some back and forth negotiation with no stakes. But the politics of the situation, I think, is really important to discuss as well. You have President Biden at the White House. You have Democratic control of the Senate. But also, even within the House, while there is a Republican majority in the House, they do not have the Republican votes in the House to pass even their own proposal or their own package. And so this idea of
Didn't they pass it?
They passed a messaging bill. But if that bill were to come back and be the real deal bill, I do not think they would have the same votes on actual final passage. And so what is really important, I think, to understand here is that it really seems that no matter what, Kevin McCarthy in the House is going to require, he needs Democrats to bail him out. This is not a situation of him holding all of the cards. And that is what makes the difference. His party is not united. And not only is it not united by a little, we're hearing and we're really seeing that most of the evidence is pointing that he only has 2/3 of his caucus. And he may need many, many Democratic votes. And so for that, I think it's really important to understand exactly how weak his hand is here. And also the options that President Biden and Democrats have are frankly much broader than the ones that he has right now.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, on a Politico podcast. Congressman Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska, was interviewed today on America First News with host Gordon Deal about the debt ceiling.
You've heard this phrase before. Is it accurate that this, for members of Congress like yourself, is a manufactured crisis?
I don't think it is. We have a real crisis of $32 trillion debt and climbing. And if we don't do anything, we're going to eventually have a 200% debt-to-GDP ratio. Any economist will tell you that's terrible. Social Security is going to go insolvent if we don't do anything. Medicare is going to go insolvent. So I just think we got to force Congress to make tough decisions to keep us solvent and on stable financial ground. So I think we have a debt crisis. Now, do we have to deal with it this week or next week because of this debt ceiling that maybe some people think's not necessary? I don't know. I think it's forcing us to have a discussion, and it's a needed discussion.
We're speaking with Nebraska Republican Congressman Don Bacon talking about the debt ceiling. Is there something that you personally would be willing to concede as part of these negotiations, even though, as you point out, the House Republicans have passed a bill to lift the debt ceiling?
Well, you know, we put maybe 5 or 6 things on the table. We're not going to get them all. And we're hoping to get 3 or 4 concessions our way, which is better than 0, because that's what the president was saying. So we know we're not going to get everything we want. We're trying to get at least half what we want, and I think that's how it works. It should work in Washington. I'm hopeful that we're going to get some kind of caps on discretionary spending. I wish we had more backbone as a Congress to tackle the growing insolvency of Social Security and Medicare. Because I don't see that courage there, I think we should have a commission to help us this year come up with a game plan to save both and then force an up or down vote on whatever is proposed. So I support that kind of thinking. We do have about $30 billion in COVID money that's not been spent. I think that's low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Supreme Court's going to rule against the tuition payout or the loans.
Debt forgiveness, yeah.
That's $400 billion right there,
yeah.
Right? So I think we're going to make some progress, maybe not as much as I want, but it's better than doing nothing.
Congressman Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska, in an America's First News interview this morning. Before the news from Washington, the debt ceiling negotiations between the White House and House Republicans have been paused. Washington Post article about it has this paragraph. The pause in talks is widely seen on Capitol Hill as a potential negotiating ploy from leaders aimed at assuring their bases that they are fighting aggressively for their side's priorities. The two groups earlier Friday had not agreed on when to meet again, according to a person familiar with the conversations. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 109, S&P down 6, NASDAQ down 30. From CNBC, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said Friday that stresses in the banking sector could mean that interest rates won't have to be as high to control inflation. Speaking at a monetary conference in Washington, the central bank leader noted that Fed initiatives used to deal with problems at mid-sized banks have mostly halted worst-case scenarios from transpiring. But he noted that the problems at Silicon Valley Bank and others could still reverberate through the economy.
When banking stresses emerged in early March, we used our liquidity tools, discount window and the bank term funding program, to make liquidity available to banks that might need it. And that liquidity supported the stability of the financial system without restricting the use of our monetary policy tools to promote price stability. While the financial stability tools helped to calm conditions in the banking sector, developments there, on the other hand, are contributing to tighter credit conditions and are likely to weigh on economic growth, hiring, and inflation. So as a result, our policy rate may not need to rise as much as it would have otherwise to achieve our goals.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at a Fed conference today in Washington. Back to the CNBC article, Jerome Powell spoke with markets mostly expecting the Fed at its June meeting to take a break from the series of rate hikes it began in March 2022. However, pricing has been volatile as Fed officials weigh the impact that policy has had and will have on inflation that in the summer of last year was running at a 41-year high. On balance, Jerome Powell said inflation is still too high. That from CNBC. More from the Fed chair at today's event.
Price stability is really the foundation of a strong economy, and that the economy doesn't work for anyone without price stability. Another is that high inflation is the responsibility and the obligation of the central bank to restore and sustain price stability. So today, while inflation isn't as high as it was when I was in college, it's nonetheless far above our 2% objective, and many people are currently experiencing high inflation for the first time in their lives. It's not a headline to say that they really don't like it. So we are very aware that high inflation imposes significant hardship as it reduces purchasing power, especially for those who are at the margins of the economy and living paycheck to paycheck and need to use all of their incoming income to pay for food, housing, and transportation and other essentials. And that's why the committee is so strongly committed to returning to our 2% goal. We think that failure to get inflation down would not only prolong the pain, but also increase, ultimately, the social costs of getting back to price stability, causing even greater harm to families and businesses. And we aim to avoid that by remaining steadfast in pursuit of our goals.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell on a panel today with former Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke, who served from 2006 through 2014. Inflation, according to the Federal Reserve's preferred measure, is at 4.6%, above the 2% long-range goal. Interest rates have risen to between 5 and 5.25%. Unemployment rate in the United States is 3.4%. Now to campaign 2024. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, was in New Hampshire today meeting with Republican state lawmakers as there were various reports this week that the governor will officially announce next week that he is a candidate for president in 2024. New Hampshire is expected to be the first of the nation presidential primary state for the Republican Party. Fox News reports that the pro-DeSantis super PAC, Never Back Down, on Tuesday announced the endorsement list of 51 lawmakers in New Hampshire who pledged to support the governor. During today's stop in Bedford, New Hampshire, Governor DeSantis talked about what he saw as the accomplishments in Florida under his leadership, and also about the country as a whole.
If you look nationally, people are very pessimistic about what's going on with the country, understandably so. And a lot of people think that, the best days of the country are behind us. But I think Florida provides a ray of hope that it doesn't have to be this way. It can get better. It's going to require a lot of fight. It's going to require that we do a lot of different things. I mean, we need to restore a sense of sanity to our society in a variety of different ways. I mean, when you have somebody competing, you know, on the men's swim team for 3 years and then switches to the women's and they say that's the women's champion, people know that that's just not right. We also have to do sanity in our basic economic policy and budget policy. Somewhere along the line, they just decided it doesn't matter how much money that you spend, that you can somehow just keep doing this indefinitely. They've added in the last 6 or 7 years, they've added like $10 trillion to the national debt. It took over 200 years in this country to reach $10 trillion. And of course, it fuels the inflation. It really makes it more difficult for working people. And it's almost like if you do the right thing and you're working hard, it's harder for you than if you don't. Like right now, they penalize, under Biden rule, they penalize prospective home buyers with good credit, so that they can subsidize people with bad credit. And you're like, is that really the incentives we want to do? And I think it creates problems when people see us with such a bad environment, because who's going to believe in the American dream at that point? I can tell you, I was growing up, I'm a blue collar kid. You know, I didn't have anything. So when I turned 18, I just worked odd jobs to get through school and everything. So minimum wage, I'm there. I remember the summer before I went to college, I worked as an electrician's assistant, 6 a.m. every morning, 5 days a week. Most of my friends were not doing that over the summer and kind of kicking back and having fun before they went off to their endeavors. But we did that. And, you know, to be able to get the paycheck, I figured, you know, I have to do this because, you know, if I do it, I work hard, it'll pay off. Now, I also learned a little bit of lesson on that in terms of government. I showed up my first day, work boots, jeans, shirt, like you would for doing that, and they sent me home. And I'm like, what did I do? I showed up on time, and they said they couldn't determine whether my work boots were OSHA approved or not. And so they said it may be a safety hazard. And they were old boots, probably somewhere in the family. And I'm like, they were really good boots. And so I had to go buy OSHA approved boots, which basically cost me about how much money I made my first week anyways. So I don't think it made me any safer. It did make me a little bit poorer, but it just showed me government was telling me what was in my interest there. And in reality, you know, it didn't end up helping me.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in Bedford, New Hampshire today. A lot of news outlets are reporting, citing people familiar with the matter, that Governor DeSantis will officially announce his candidacy for president in 2024 next week. Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, officially declaring himself a candidate for the Republican nomination for president today, filing the paperwork with the Federal Election Commission. New York Times writes that Senator Scott will announce his candidacy for president on Monday and will enter the race with around $22 million in cash on hand, making him one of the most serious competitors for the frontrunner, Donald Trump. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Background music at the G7 summit in Hiroshima, Japan, at the so-called family photo where the leaders of the G7 nations pose together. Those nations are the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, France, Canada, Italy, and Japan. Leaders also laid wreaths at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. Hiroshima was the site of the first atomic bombing by the U.S. in 1945 during World War II. On Ukraine, the G7 leaders putting out a joint statement that they, quote, reaffirm our commitment to stand together against Russia's illegal, unjustifiable and unprovoked war of aggression against Ukraine. Statement also says our support for Ukraine will not waver, and Russia started this war and can end this war. The European Union is a non-enumerated member of the G7. The EU president, Charles Michel, spoke at a news conference in Hiroshima about Russia's war.
The Kremlin continues to fan the flames of war across Ukraine. In the EU, we are working hard to get Ukraine what they need, more weapons, more ammunition, and faster. This will be crucial to its counteroffensive. We have stood by the people of Ukraine since day one with solidarity and resolve, and we will keep it up for as long as it takes. We will reaffirm our support for Ukraine's effort towards lasting peace, our EU support for Zelensky's peace formula. Any credible peace plan must be anchored in the principles of UN Charter, territorial sovereignty, and territorial integrity. One thing is clear, it's only up to Ukraine to decide when to consider negotiations.
European Union President Charles Michel at a news conference in Hiroshima, Japan. Also on the agenda at the G7, relations with China. John Kirby, the Strategic Communications Director for the U.S. National Security Council, did an interview on Bloomberg TV.
I can't speak for what China's doing with each individual Pacific Island nation. They have used a mix of intimidation and coercion, economic and security-wise, to try to have their way in this part of the world. We are not asking countries to choose between the United States and China. They get to decide what their bilateral relationships look like and who they associate with and what that association looks like. What we are doing is trying to show in demonstrable way in ways that the United States is a reliable, stable, credible partner in this part of the world and around the world, and to give people alternatives to the coercion and the intimidation that the Chinese tend to demonstrate.
How close are G7 leaders aligned on this point, on making sure they are de-risking from China? Most notably, I'm thinking of Europe and Emmanuel Macron after his visit, where he said that Europe actually has strategic autonomy when it comes to China.
China's going to be key on the agenda here in Japan, and I think you're going to see the G7 leaders all speak with one voice about the challenges that China poses here in the Indo-Pacific and around the world, but also what some of the opportunities are as the G7 nations are to compete fairly, but to compete well with China.
John Kirby, spokesperson for the National Security Council, interviewed by Bloomberg Television. Daniel Lipman, Politico, White House, and Washington reporter, has been following the G7 summit in Hiroshima, Japan, joining us now on the phone. Thank you for being on Washington Today. What issues are being discussed by the leaders and decisions made?
Well, there's a number of issues that are being discussed in Japan. Chief among them is Ukraine and China in terms of how the West is going to make sure that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is not a success, which they've had some progress in pushing back, tremendous progress pushing back Russia by supporting Ukraine. But there are questions about, F-16, training for F-16 fighter jets. That is something that Biden appears to be getting behind. And also how to deal with China and the rise of China and the West and the threat it poses to Western values and norms.
When it comes to Russia's war in Ukraine, we were hearing that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky may be making an appearance at the G7.
Yeah, we're getting kind of conflicting information on that. And I guess his schedule is up in the air. At first, we thought he was going to the G7 in Japan, then he's in Saudi Arabia, or he's on his way to Saudi Arabia to do a Middle Eastern summit. And so we just don't know yet. But if he can be there, I'm sure he will be, because he wants to make the personal case to get as much aid and armaments as possible in his fight against Russia.
President Biden will be cutting his trip short to return to Washington and dealing with the debt limit issue here. And because of that, they're going to be holding a meeting with the so-called Quad while they were at the summit itself in Japan. What's going on there?
Yeah, we were supposed to go to Papua New Guinea and Australia, and he has to return to Washington to deal with the final negotiations for the debt ceiling, the raising the debt ceiling and avoiding the default, and that's more important than visiting a small island country. And so he was obviously disappointed, and they pointed fingers at Kevin McCarthy's team for making this kind of required that Biden has to be back. But they know that the global cataclysm that would occur if we default on our debt is much more important than a trip that they can always reschedule for later. This was much more time sensitive.
We're talking with Daniel Lipman from Politico. There are reports of some protests in the street in Hiroshima, Japan. One of the controversies is whether the U.S. president should apologize for the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima in 1945.
Yeah, no, I think it's by having the G7 in Hiroshima, that was kind of these protests are not that unexpected. I don't think Biden is going to apologize for doing that. That is not his decision. And the U.S., a lot of people in the U.S. still think that it was necessary to end the World War II and force the Japanese to surrender. But I think Biden has talked about nuclear disarmament, and that is on the agenda as well, along with issues like climate change, gender, and the world economy, and all of that. And so, but don't expect apology. Remember, Republicans would always hit Democrats for apologizing for America.
When the G7 leaders get together, on occasion, the headlines that come out of it use the word tension. Sometimes, but sometimes not. Are there any tensions this time?
Well, these are pretty, I think there are some tensions with France and the U.S. Over China, because Macron visited China in the last month or two, and he said that the West and Europe should rely less on American superiority and world power, and that he was kind of talking about how China can play a role in the world. And so those were troubling comments, because obviously no one wants to stop China from developing, but it's, given that they're an authoritarian country and that there are issues with their treatment of minorities and respect, that is a real hurdle for countries to get over, in terms of the U.S. has Western values and we respect people's human rights. And so maybe if China got better on those topics, then we would be happier for them to share the world stage.
Daniel Lipman, Politico White House and Washington reporter. His story is at Politico.com and on Twitter at DLipman. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
An article at The Verge: automakers would be required to keep AM radio in their vehicles under a new bipartisan bicameral bill introduced today. The legislation was introduced in response to an increasing number of vehicles coming out without the first-generation radio broadcast technology. The bill, titled the AM for Every Vehicle Act, would direct the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to issue a rule that requires automakers to maintain AM broadcast radio in their vehicles without a separate or additional payment, fee, or surcharge. The lead House sponsor, Congressman Josh Gottheimer, Democrat from New Jersey, took part in a virtual news conference on Thursday.
The issue we're facing is that many auto and EV manufacturers are looking to take AM radio out of their vehicles just to save a few bucks. Companies like Tesla have already removed AM, and Ford plans to remove AM from their gas-powered Mustang. Here's the problem. AM radio is the backbone behind America's national public warning system. For emergency alert info from FEMA to the public during national disasters, extreme weather, chemical incidents, health emergencies, and of course, domestic terror threats. That's because AM radio is resilient to cyber attacks, nuclear threats, and natural disasters. So when the cell phone goes out, internet gets cut off, or television doesn't work because there's no power to your house, you can still use AM radio. It'll be there. We have battle-hardened, high-powered stations equipped with backup equipment, and generators that cover 90% of our population and can be heard from thousands of miles away. In Jersey, during the aftermath of 9/11 and Hurricane Sandy, AM radio was there, providing a crucial lifeline for life-saving information when other news resources went out. Its signals, AM radio, can travel longer distances than FM or satellite radio signals and can penetrate buildings. But despite the clear public safety uses of AM radio, many EV manufacturers apparently don't care. These companies say the electromagnetic noise from their electric cars can disrupt the reception of AM signals. But that's a ridiculous argument, because we know that early Teslas used to have well-functioning AM radio. Others like GM and Stellantis, formerly the Fiat Chrysler, still do. But like Tesla, Ford has discontinued AM radio because it costs a few bucks to add an adapter to make it work. Now others are following suit. I've said it before. If Elon Musk has enough money to buy Twitter and send rockets to space, he can certainly afford to include AM radio in his Teslas. Instead, Elon Musk and Tesla and other manufacturers are putting public safety and emergency response at risk. These companies also claim that AM radio isn't relevant anymore. As you heard the senator say, that's the furthest thing from the truth. Actually, 47 million people tune into AM radio every day to listen to news, traffic, and weather. And of course, as you heard, it's also a source for Spanish radio and other forms of radio. So I've written to major EV companies, Tesla, Ford, Volkswagen, Volvo, BMW, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, and Polestar, urging them to reconsider their decision and to include the public safety tool as a stock feature. Back in March, I called on NHTSA to add AM radio to the federal motor vehicle safety standards and make it a minimum standard, just like airbags, brakes, and seatbelts. I've also asked FEMA to look into this and immediately contact automakers, since AM radio is a vital emergency management tool. Today, we're joining together to announce the bipartisan, bicameral AM for Every Vehicle Act to require automakers to maintain AM radio in vehicles without an additional fee to the consumer. Auto manufacturers need to realize the importance of AM radio as a critical tool for public safety. It will be there when we need it, as it always has.
Congressman Josh Gottheimer, Democrat from New Jersey, in a virtual news conference on Thursday. The senator he referred to is Ed Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts. This is a bipartisan bill in the Senate. One of the co-sponsors is Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas. And in the House, a co-sponsor is Bruce Westerman, Republican from Arkansas. NorthJersey.com has an article with this. A full 40% of radio listening is done in cars, according to Forbes magazine. If Detroit decrees that cars will no longer have AM, it is doubtful how long the platform itself could stay commercially viable. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.